Hey, everybody. I've got a little bit of housekeeping here before we get into the episode about Instagram and Theology Beer Camp. So I've been getting more active on Instagram, and I just want to let you guys know, in case you want to see me make some videos where I look directly into the camera, I'm sharing some stories and posts about basically all the topics that we cover on this show over at Instagram.com/DanKoke. That's C-O-K-E, and the link is in the show notes. Also, Theology Beer Camp is returning in 2024, October 17th through 19th. The theme is Return of the God Pods. That is a Lord of the Rings reference, which should surprise nobody. I will be there alongside Brian McLaren, Diana Butler-Bass, The New Evangelicals, Bible for Normal People, Tony and Josh from GGCH, of course, Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity, and a whole grip of others. And you can use the promo code RETURNOFYHP, all one word, for $25 off your ticket. Prices go up starting June 1st. That link will be in the notes. I hope to see a bunch of you guys there in October. It was a serious highlight of last year for me. My name is Dan Koch. Like many of you, I've been on a complicated faith journey for a number of years now. And while I tend to find myself on the progressive side of Christianity, my goal is not to make liberal converts. I want this show to be a resource for Christians to my right and to my left, as well as former Christians and non-religious folks, anyone who finds themselves asking difficult questions about God, science, prayer, fate, suffering, evangelism, and more. So many of us have been given bad answers to those good questions, often by people with pure intentions. I want to say that you have permission to take both Christianity and the modern world very seriously. And I hope to facilitate that by introducing you to people seeking God across the Christian spectrum, engaging hard questions in a multitude of ways. Thanks for listening. You Have Permission is now also on YouTube. Going forward, pretty much every episode will be here in audio form on the podcast feed and also in video form on the YouTube channel. There are some benefits to watching YouTube. Obviously, you can see my face and my guests' faces, but also occasionally I'll use visual aids of one sort or another to kind of highlight something that we are talking about. Everything will still be here in audio form and still be understandable to an audio-only audience. I know that is primarily going to be the case, at least for quite a while. But if you're interested in YouTube, head over to the link in the show notes, subscribe to that channel, and see which episodes are available there in video form. Thanks. Dr. Melinda Berry, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Absolutely. I'm excited about where this conversation is going to go.
So am I. You were heartily recommended by Kristen Tideman, who does media and marketing stuff for us and appears with me on our Q&A episodes that we've been doing. You are a professor at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary. Mm-hmm. And let's kind of start there because you're Black mm-hmm. and you're a Mennonite.
Yes.
And that's just not a thing that I have a lot of examples of. I think of Amish people. If I'm not thinking Amish, I'm thinking like Myron Penner, friend of the podcast, mm-hmm. friend of mine, who's a, you know, lives in Canada and there's the ethnic part of Mennonite.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know what I'm saying. So maybe that's a good entrance into kind of figuring out a little bit about your story.
I think that's a great place to start. The things that you said are definitely true, and they're also kind of part of my background. I would say, you know, for transparency purposes here, I am, or, you know, I tend to think of myself as mixed race. My mother is white and comes out of that deeply ethnic stream of Mennonites that you were describing. So, for example, I did the 23andMe DNA thing, and the strand of DNA that I get from my mother can be located to a very specific canton of Switzerland where Mennonites are known to have come from.
Yeah.
And then on my father's side of the family, my dad is Black. It's much more mixed up. And you can also kind of track using these tools on the 23andMe website.
Right.
That we've got DNA that starts off in the southeastern part of the African continent, and then it mixes with some European DNA, and then it moves to the middle of the continent, mixes with more European DNA.
So before, insane that you can track that stuff,
right,
by the way.
Right.
It's incredible. Yeah.
So this mixture, well, for me, I mean, it's complex, but it's also joyful because then I get to inhabit these different kinds of spaces and people are like, oh, I didn't expect you to be here.
Yeah.
And so a part of my identity is kind of disrupting the standard narrative. Now, having said that, one little fun fact that most people don't know about Mennonites is that the largest Mennonite congregation in North America is a predominantly African-American congregation in Virginia.
Huh.
Calvary Community Church. It's a congregation that is now being pastored by the third generation of the Francisco family. Hmm. So there is this kind of funky, bifurcated thing happening among contemporary Mennonites, where, especially in a Canadian context with the federal policy around multiculturalism, Mennonite identity is this deeply ethnic identity. The parallel can be made to talking about Judaism, like Jewish identity, where there's an ethnic dynamic, a cultural dynamic, and for some people, a religious practice,
right,
that goes along with it. So I certainly am kind of in touch with that, but I also have this deep part of my background that is an example of the 16th century principles that we often like to hearken back to when we talk about Mennonites and the Anabaptist movement of the Believer's Church, where while you may be born into a tradition, you aren't Christian until you, as a matter of conscience, make this declaration and decision. So I live with that tension because it comes to me from both sides of my family, where my dad grew up poor, Black, and in the South during segregation. And so for him, there was a pathway to a better life that came to him through the work of some conservative Mennonite mission workers who were bringing Vacation Bible School to the poor Black kids on the migrant farms.
Wow.
So, you know, it's complicated. It's complicated. I enjoy showing up in some of these spaces as a little bit of a disruption.
Sure.
Also being able to weave together these different strands of what it means to be Mennonite in the 21st century.
The first thing I'm thinking is just on the surface, it's not obvious to me why there wouldn't be more of a Black Anabaptist or Mennonite presence, because at least just thinking in terms of like nonviolence as a defining characteristic, I mean, that's possibly the defining characteristic of the way that the Black Christian church in America has pursued, you know, racial justice and other political
and
ends.
So
I wonder if you have any insight into why that's actually not a bigger thing, because you would think that would really, not to mention even the Baptist part. You mentioned Believer's Church, Believer's Baptism. That's the Baptist part of Anabaptist, and there's a lot of Black Baptists.
I
don't know if there's anything there that's worth talking about.
Yeah, there are a couple of things. So there is this Believer's Church conference that happens every several years. And to my knowledge, the most recent one actually did happen, was sponsored by some historic Black colleges and universities that are part of the Baptist tradition. And, you know, hey, I'm just going to tell the truth. Like, I didn't hear any Mennonites, you know, in my neck of the woods, where there are quite a few, saying, hey, let's get ourselves organized and go participate in this conference, right? That maybe gets us to a little bit further into some of the particularities or peculiarities mm-hmm. of this tradition that might also help signal why there aren't more Black Mennonites. So one of the realities of this European tradition of Anabaptism, let's also be clear here too, that at this point in history, there are more Mennonites outside of North America than there are in North America. So that dynamic around the global South or the majority church, as some people talk about it.
Right.
It's certainly true in our tradition that, and I think I've heard, you know, our missiologists and sociologists trot out statistics that the average Mennonite, when you look at the global context, is a woman from Africa, right? One of my ancestors, kind of thing, right? Or somebody to whom I might be, you know, connected by DNA. I don't know.
Yeah.
But in North America, the Mennonite presence here historically was very what we call sectarian. There are different migratory waves of Mennonites, because the way we understand our own history going back to the 16th century was that there were different groups of Anabaptists popping up around Europe. We locate those primarily in southern Germany, the Netherlands, some in northern Germany, Prussia, Switzerland, and parts of France. And so depending on which one of those little hotspots you can track your lineage back to, there's going to be a connection with when your people hopped across the Atlantic and landed on North American and then also sometimes South American soil.
Correct me if I'm wrong on the sectarian thing. I don't know a ton about Anabaptist history, but a lot of religious persecution, right? Because
yes.
a posture of nonviolence means non-involvement in the military. And every once in a while, countries require you to be involved in the military.
Sure.
Wars come up, et cetera. And then that's going to put you at natural odds. And then there's going to be, and so then that kind of makes sense of the sectarian. We're removed from the world a bit. We're doing our own thing. Obviously, yeah. Amish being the strongest example, but there's more chill examples. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I do want to tweak what the picture you painted just a little bit, not because it's inaccurate. Well, there's some like scholarly debates around some of this stuff, like that gets us into like whether our self-understanding is that we're nonviolent, like we're committed to nonviolence, or our version of nonviolence is something called biblical non-resistance. So it's like, again, like, you know, if we get in the time machine and go back 500 years, one of the big defining features of Anabaptism in that European context, like you said, was being at odds with the state, but it might actually be a little bit more useful for us to think about that less in terms of a kind of pacifistic ethic, although that was true, but it was more of a kind of, we sometimes talk about this as a two kingdom theology, this very clear sense that the church and the state should not be the same thing.
Interesting.
We sometimes talk about this as the Constantinian shift, where the minute Western Christianity, you know, goes hand in glove with the Roman state.
With Rome, yeah.
Okay, that's where everything
went
wrong.
That's where we jumped the shark, right, exactly.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's a level at which Anabaptism sees itself as trying to get back to that apostolic church. Mm-hmm. So like we, for example, we have this book called The Martyr's Mirror that was published in the Netherlands where the persecution was dying down a little bit. And so there was a sense, well, we've got to make sure that the young people know that we don't get along with our neighbors who aren't Anabaptists. And so you tell this story of this martyrdom story.
Okay.
That starts with Jesus. And then it goes all through the period of persecution in the early church up to the 16th century. And with this self-understanding that we're martyrs, that we're suffering because we critique the apparatus of the state.
Sure.
We are enacting civil disobedience by not being baptized as infants, because your baptism as an infant is the thing that gets you citizenship.
Citizenship. And kind of what Kierkegaard was talking about, right?
Yeah.
Just to make a really quick psychological through line here, a much milder version, but I'm trying to sort of place myself in any kind of similar story. And growing up, you know, evangelical in California, there's no kind of obvious state and ethnic stuff. The one thing, though, that's resonating for me is being kind of catechized into punk rock as a teenager. Mm-hmm. What sets us apart is our criticism of the system. we distrust authority or whatever. Obviously, that's a pale version because basically zero punk rockers ever died for their beliefs. They might have died from overdosing or, you know, whatever, sure. But they were not executed by the state or anything like that for, you know, but that kind of against the apparatus of evil. That kind of is kind of lighting up some memories for me.
Yeah. Well, and I'm nodding my head vigorously because, okay, sure. Yes, you're right that the level of sacrifice is sort of different. But I would also say, as somebody who was born and raised with this European tradition as part of my formation, like, we were taught not to forget the martyr stories. Like, that yeah. was the template.
Huh.
Now, people who within our tradition who've done like trauma-informed peace building and psychology can now say, oh, isn't this interesting?
Yes.
Because we hopped across the water and we're no longer in the place where this persecution happened. This stuff stays as a kind of template trauma story because studies have shown that when a group experiences persecution, if they stay in the physical geographical space where that happened, the likelihood of working through the trauma and integrating that experience into the community's life in generative ways is much higher.
Yeah.
So Mennonites in the United States and Canada are kind of a great case study for the displacement, exile, trauma, all that being kind of mapped together and a central part of how we transmit our faith.
Let me do a little Dan psychoeducation corner yeah. here to put into perspective here. So when you're working with trauma, mm-hmm. as far as I know, every single therapeutic modality, which is basically just, you know, a treatment style or a set of whatever that we do to actually treat trauma in a client, every single one includes exposure therapy as a major plank. And the reason for that is what's called the extinction principle. And other people who know more about this than me could probably explain it better, but here's how I explain it to clients. The extinction principle is one of the most basic neurological principles we know of. If you present a stimulus to a brain and it produces, let's say, a 100 reaction, each time you present it, as long as you don't wait too long, now it's going to be a 98, then a 96, then a 93, now it's an 88. And it just chills out over time the same stimulus. This is why time heals most wounds, is that you think of the wounds. And every time you think about it, it hurts a little bit less. Mm-hmm. So if you are in a physical location, and if the rituals and meanings and whatever that you have derived from the group suffering, if those things are embodied and you walk past them, if you have a shrine to a dead loved one in your house that you walk past every day, you are using the extinction principle. Mm-hmm. And the amount of pain or whatever other distress that you feel, it just goes down each time. So that would be my guess. Now, I haven't read this research, but I would assume that it's something like that. If you're there present, then you mm-hmm. are working through it, whether you realize it or not. But if you're away, right. then you don't have the exposure. Is that lining up with what you understand?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And in fact, in certain Mennonite communities, and I would say I come out of one of those, We actually use the same logic, but in reverse. And what I mean by that is because we've been displaced geographically, we expose our youth and our children to the stories of our martyr heritage,
yeah.
which has a visual cultural component, so that they never forget.
Right.
Right. So because the belief is, if we don't teach them these stories, if we don't show them these images, then they will forget, right?
Well, that seems true, right?
Yeah.
At a basic level, right. If you don't teach it to them, they're not going to know it. That's true.
Right. And so what's being taught is like this frozen in time kind of story. Mm-hmm. So for example, probably the most famous, well-known readily recognized image that comes out of this book, The Martyr's Mirror, is of a man named Dirk Willems. So Dirk was imprisoned in the Netherlands for being an Anabaptist. Because again, the understanding here is that when you either renounce the baptism you received as a child, or you are baptized again, or you've refused baptism from the state, you are, like, that's a crime, right? So that's what you're being jailed for.
It's just, it's so hard to put myself back in that mindset.
I know. It's kind of crazy.
It's worth just noting, listeners, if you don't know much about European Christian history, like, every European country basically for hundreds of years had, like, almost everyone had an official state church, which was aligned with one denomination or other. If it wasn't Catholic, then it was one of the Protestant denominations, or maybe it changed some year, right? Like, eventually Germany and some of these other, like, Scandinavian ones became Protestant or Lutheran. And that was your citizenship. And like I mentioned Kierkegaard earlier, he's speaking in the 19th century in Denmark, living in Copenhagen. And he's like, "What? This is not fucking Christianity. Like, this is citizenship." And that's really the kind of the strain and the backdrop of what you're saying for Anabaptists.
Exactly. So Dirk, I've lost a few of the details. Like, did he break out of prison? Was there a warrant out for his arrest? Like, what the extenuating circumstances are?
An adventure hero of some sort, though.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
He is. It's the middle of winter. He is fleeing his pursuers. So these are our prison wardens, you know, folks hired by the local sheriff or whatever to go catch the Anabaptists. So Dirk goes out on an icy canal, and the man who's running after him weighs more than he does, breaks through the ice, and is drowning. Dirk decides to turn around and help this man out of the water, saves his life. So the image is like, you're out on the ice. This man is reaching out through the ice.
Yeah.
Dirk turns around and is reaching out toward this man, pulls him out of the ice. They make it to shore. Guess what? Dude arrests Dirk anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Dirk dies. Right. So this is the principles being demonstrated here are what we call defenselessness, being defenseless Christians, which is a piece of the what translates later on, especially in the 20th century, into pacifism. At that point, it's simply what's being referred to as biblical non-resistance. Dirk is resisting, not the evildoer. Right. So and he is not trying to defend himself. Just like Jesus did not defend himself when he went to the cross, we do not use force to defend ourselves. So obedience unto death is what's happening here.
It's really, I mean, I kind of want to pause there and just say, that's a really fucking powerful story and image and set of principles. Like, I was not catechized into that vision of Christianity, but I recognize its power. And I recognize it as really being sort of more committed to this worldly acceptance of consequences for values and beliefs than any form of Christianity I have ever practiced. And I don't know how much we're going to get into nonviolence generally and where I kind of get off the bus. I don't know that that's important to talk about, but I recognize that I also, like, it's worth, I think, admitting that I don't know that I have the fortitude, you know, regardless of what I also might think about, you know, nuclear weapons and stuff like that, which informs some of my thinking on it at a personal level. Like, geez, like, that is just so, what a calling that is. And I do have tremendous respect for people, including those who have been imprisoned or killed, who have stuck to it, you know, like, that's just, I just don't want to paper over that or kind of breeze past it.
Cause
it's, I mean, I know it's part of your milieu, but it's not part of mine. And it's just really powerful.
Well, I really do appreciate you pausing there, Dan, because Well, not only in reflecting back what you're, some of what you're hearing, as well as talking about your own experience, that's inviting me to absorb that. So part of the work that I do, I identify myself as a peace theologian. You know, my work, my vocation, my job involves being what some people might describe as a critical caretaker of this tradition of peace theology, of pacifism, of biblical non-resistance, of Christian nonviolence. And so I'm sort of running through this to like get to the critiques or like get to the reconstructive pieces. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's okay to just sit with this. Yeah. And for me to reflect like I already did. Yeah, I don't even know the extenuating circumstances around Dirk Willems' story, regardless of how many times I've heard that fucking thing.
Right.
What sticks with me is this very visual, very visceral lesson. That's what we do.
Yeah.
That's who we are. That's how we relate to people who don't understand us. We put ourselves on the line.
Like before I had kids, I thought I would be nonviolent. I'm nonviolent personally. And now that I have a child, I'm like, I'm not sure that intruder is entitled to, you know, of course I don't have any and I don't feel various complicated feelings about firearms and in our kind of culture of gun dependence, especially in the States. And, you know, I'm not a participant in that culture at all, but yeah, kind of struggling. I want to leave this in because I think the struggling is indicative of something that what this stuff does is it gets at just really fucking core, difficult, principled kind of stuff.
Well, and I want to jump in here and say really quickly, so one of the things that's also true is there are a lot of ways to be nonviolent.
You can listen to the rest of this episode by joining the Patreon at patreon.com/Dan Koch.